I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Nino Ricci is one of Canada's most distinguished and premier novelists. His new book is The Origin of Species, and like his previous works, it is already a critically acclaimed success. It has been described as poignant, humorous, and searing. Its publication is one of the fall season's most important events in the book industry. The book follows Alex, a 30-something Montrealer in the 1980s. He's the center of the book, and we follow him through the decade's events and some extraordinary experiences in his life. The book is published by Doubleday and retails for $34.95. Joining me now from here in Vancouver on the Plant Online program is Nino Ricci. Good morning, Mr. Ricci.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I'm going to try to pronounce Alex's last name. Alex Fratarkinjeli?
That'll do. That's the usual Canadian pronunciation, I guess. The actual Italian pronunciation is Fratarkinjeli.
In my
hometown in Ontario, it was always Fratarkinjeli.
Is that a common name?
I don't know that it's that common. I chose it because it sticks out a bit. It's not actually a name from my parents' home region. It's more from the Trecaria region on the Roman side of the peninsula. And I chose it for that reason, because it stuck out and because it was non-native to the area my parents came from, so that it would be a kind of commentary on origins.
So tell me about Alex and what we see when we were introduced to him in the book.
Well, Alex is, in some ways, I thought of him as a kind of everyman, just sort of trying to make sense of the barrage of demands and information and stresses that most of us have in our daily lives. But with him, I guess the stress is ratcheted up a few points because of a few very specific events. One was something that happened to him several years earlier in the Galapagos, when he took an unintended trip there that ended up changing the direction of his life. Another is that he's recently discovered that he's a father, that he has a 5-year-old son in Sweden that he knew nothing about, and that is the product of a relationship he'd had at the time. In addition to those sort of bigger questions, there are a number of smaller ones confronting him, including this dissertation that he's working on that he can't seem to make any headway on.
He's studying evolutionary biology and literary theory.
Yes, he's trying to find a point of union between the two. He's trying to develop a theory of narrative based on evolutionary theory. Now, when I started this book, when I first thought of this book years ago, I thought this was a kind of wacky, an original idea, but it turns out that there's a whole school out there that is doing exactly that. And in the course of my research, I came across some of their work. And in fact, the kind of work that they're doing is quite fascinating. I think it probably goes off in a slightly different direction than Alex does, but it all starts from the same basis: this idea that there can be a point of contact between, well, essentially between the sciences and the arts, and that something like evolutionary theory can actually give us useful information about how to understand culture and literature.
And from their research and from your writing this book, at that intersection, what do you see?
Well, I found a lot of convincing arguments. First of all, the idea that storytelling, we don't like to think of art as something functional, and yet clearly it performs a function in society. It's been around a long time. You find that civilizations, one of the first things that societies do is develop some form of art, whether it be cave paintings or poetry or music or storytelling. So clearly it's doing something. Clearly it's serving a social function. And I think the function that it serves is a kind of integration or synthesis of information that can't be got at really in any other way. Can't be got at by, you know, a straight stating of the facts or by some more empirical approach to the facts. But it's something that proceeds by a more almost instinctive and intuitive way of knowing the world, and puts it together in a way that makes sense for other people. So stories serve as roadmaps, I think, for fallen generations. They serve as a way of making sense of the multiple input, I guess, that we get, and forming them into some kind of a pattern that helps us in our lives in ways that we can't perhaps quite put into words, but that are crucial, I think, to our survival in some larger sense of the word survival.
And you've been fascinated with Darwin for a long time, haven't you?
Well, I think this goes back to a course I did in first year university. In fact, I had an email from a professor who I think was the first person to introduce me to The Origin of Species in first year. And I think that's when the seed was planted, probably for this novel. I knew that at some point in my life I'd want to confront these kinds of issues in fiction. A few years after that, I read a book called The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins that got me thinking a little more deeply about the subject. And I guess Dawkins' central insight was to take evolution down to the level of the gene. His point being that, you know, evolution doesn't happen at the level of organisms, but at the level that genes make decisions and that genes struggle to survive. And by taking it down to the gene, he was able to explain things like altruism or to present a credible theory for why altruism happens and how altruism is not necessarily a contradiction of evolutionary law. So for me, this was it had a fairly strong impact on me because it overthrew a lot of my own ideas about morality and social mores. I didn't really know how I would ever work this out in fiction. Though a few years later, when I was living in Montreal, I met a woman. I became very close friends with a woman who was suffering from multiple sclerosis. And she was someone who had a big impact on my life, because she was really, you know, confronting the big questions. And although she was someone who was fighting for her life and facing a dark future, she was nonetheless someone who gave a tremendous amount of joy and encouragement and love to people around her. And I didn't think of it at the time, but subsequently it occurred to me that, you know, the contradictions that you see in something like evolutionary theory were very present in her and in her life. She was someone who, you know, by normal natural law should not have existed, should have been sort of bred out of existence. And yet she was such a force for good in so many people's lives. I guess in thinking about her was the real seed. The moment in which I think I had found a way into this question that was human and that would be relevant and it would not be some kind of dry treatment of a scientific theory.
You dedicate the book to the memory of Esther. The character in the book, her name is Esther as well, is it?
Yes, it is, yes. And the Esther in the book is based fairly closely on the Esther who was my friend, and I seldom do that. I seldom try to capture real people that directly, not only for, you know, legal reasons, but because most people are just not interesting enough, really, to sustain fiction. They don't have sufficient, I guess, drama or stresses in their lives. But Esther was someone who was really larger than life, and was much stronger in life than any character I could have created on my own. And my real fear was that I wouldn't be able to capture her. And in a way, the book is a tribute to her and to the force that she was and the positive effect she had on so many people's lives.
Her relationship with Alex in the book is what? The Esther in your book.
My relationship with Alex?
Pardon me, the relationship of Alex to Esther in the book is what?
Well, it's a friendship. I mean, it's... I don't want to give too much away.
No.
It's a complicated relationship that has various nuances to it. But essentially, it evolves into a very... almost kind of intuitive friendship. I mean, by towards the end, it's the main communication that's going on between them is that Alex sits in her hospital room and reads to her from Les Misérables, and isn't even really sure if she can hear him or understand him. And yet, this almost animal kind of communication continues on between them throughout.
And how much of Alex comes from you? Like, I know you created Alex, you wrote Alex, but I mean, in terms of yourself, do you see him in you?
Well, this is a question that authors always dread, because they always think, well, what scene is he thinking of? They ask that question.
Right, right.
And what scene will readers associate if I answer in particular ways? I mean, I think that the standard answer, but also the truthful answer, is that yes, there's some of me, but finally, he is a fictional creation. So I always start with myself, because I just know myself probably better than I know most people. I delude myself into thinking that. And I need something solid to begin with, some sense of authority. But I don't think of my novels as about me, or I don't think of writing a novel as a way of getting my personality out there. I think of it as a way to get a story out there, and I'll use any materials I have at my disposal to do that, anything that I know, however I know it. So whether it comes from myself, or things that I've seen in other people, or things that I've read, or things that I've made up, I will use them. And inevitably, parts of me get in there, but if the novel is going to work, at a very early stage, some separation has to occur, and the character has to take on his own life and his own story. I usually find it's very important to make that separation early on, to avoid, you know, throwing in things into the story that seem interesting to me simply because they happen to me. You know, I only want to include in the story things that are important to the story.
How do you view the 1980s? I was born in the 80s, so I don't really know the decade very well, but having lived through it, I mean, how do you view it now and through the rearview mirror, if you will?
Well, not with nostalgia, right? But there is a kind of nostalgia. It's almost as if we were innocent in the 80s when you, you know, a lot of the problems that we have now were foreseen in the 80s, but they were taken as kind of, you know, the crackpots preaching doom. So all the stuff you hear about the environment, all that was being said in the 80s, but it was the fringe. It was the dismissible fringe that seemed to be saying it. Well, it turned out they were right, but at the time we could go along in our, you know, complacent consumerism, feeling that, you know, there were always the naysayers. It was also, I think, the beginning of the present era. You know, Reagan was elected in 1980, and, you know, I think yesterday, Alan Greenspan admitted he was wrong about his economic policies. Well, he came in with Reagan. So we're seeing the tail end of you know, a free market experiment that began really in that era, that sort of spelled the end of the 60s and the beginning of a new kind of economic model of society that I think now is showing its faults, and the book, in a way, is a lot about that. It's about, you know, Darwinism. It's also about ideas of social Darwinism. Do human beings run their societies on Darwinian models? What happens when you do that? Is that an efficacious way of running human society? So that was, I mean, that's not at the overt level of text, but it is in the subtext, and it was in the back of my mind as I was writing this book, that in some ways the 80s are us. And in fact, a lot of things that are happening now, the war on terrorism, for instance, that phrase was first coined in the 80s. That Ronald Reagan was using that term when he was, you know, fighting the evil empire of Libya. So, you know, everything old is new again, it seems. We think that we are at the forefront of these new dilemmas and new movements, but in fact we're living out things that started years ago.
There are a couple of things in the book that interested me. First of all, Alex, he idolized Trudeau.
Yes.
And he had imaginary conversations with Peter Zosky.
Yes.
On Zosky, because I'll ask you about Trudeau in a sec when I ask you about your current project. But on Zosky, what did he mean to you?
Well, I guess what he meant to me is not that important. What concerned me in the novel is what he meant to the country. I had contact with Peter Zarsky. I was interviewed by him a couple of times, and I had sort of very limited interaction with him as a writer. But I guess as a human being before I became a writer, I, like so many people in the country, listened to Morningside, and I really started listening to it when I moved to Quebec, when I moved to Montreal, and it really was the way in which I became aware of myself as a Canadian person, I guess, at the point at which I had to start thinking about issues of national identity, because I was living in this environment where that identity was in constant conflict. I sort of turned to him. So this sense of pan-Canadianism that I had... I never had. So much like Alex in the book, I felt that he was really the person who gave me that larger sense of what it might mean to belong to this country. At the same time, he occupied this very particular place as a kind of quintessential Canadian, or as a crystallization of what we like to think of as our best qualities, polite and nice, but also, at the end of the day, getting the goods. He had this very rambling, stuttering kind of interview style, and yet he always managed to get to the bottom of things. And I think in some ways he epitomized our best selves, or our concept of our best selves. At the same time, you did hear stories about it, but off air he was quite different. And, those stories varied. Some of them portrayed him in quite a negative light, but I think probably the truth about him is that he was quite a shy man, and as soon as the mic was turned off, he retreated into his other side. He had to find some respite from the public eye, and sometimes came across as cantankerous, antisocial, and so on. And what I think he was trying to do in the novel was really explore this duality. Using him as sort of an obvious symbol, but exploring it within the larger context of Canadians as a whole and people as a whole, how we do this, how we present this light side, our best self to the public, and what we suppress in doing that, and what doesn't get out. And I think this is it's particularly true in Canada, where we sometimes have a kind of smugness about ourselves that I think often masks much darker things, things like racism and bigotry and so on. We are not people to really bring those things out in the open, and yet sometimes in burying them it makes them more insidious.
And you're working on a biography of Pierre Trudeau for the John Ralston Saul series for Viking, right?
Yes.
No other Canadian I can think of in the 20th century has been written about more than Pierre Trudeau. In this book that you're writing, what new will you be bringing to light about this guy who's been written so much about?
That's what all my friends keep asking me as well.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Why are you writing another book on Trudeau? The idea of this series was not to write definitive biographies, but to comment on the cultural importance of various figures, and various of them have been done so far. So that was my approach, and the reason John Ralston Saul chose non-experts or non-biographers to do it is because they often bring a different kind of perspective. They inevitably will put things together in a different way. So I'm using, the basic facts. In some ways, despite the large amount that's been written on Trudeau, we do have a new kind of Trudeau now since his archive has been open, and there's been relatively little published since then, because all kinds of stuff have come out in the archive that have given a really different spin to Trudeau, and that really require almost a full reinterpretation of him. So I think that requires some work, and I think there's necessity still for a lot more to be said about Trudeau. But also, I guess I'm just trying to take that backward step and sort of step above the polemics about Trudeau, because it's very hard to read anything about Trudeau that isn't on one side or the other of him, that isn't either you know, hagiography or demonization. So to step beyond that and think less about what Trudeau was and more about what he meant to us and how he functioned as a kind of symbol for Canadians.
And is that what you're primarily working on now, or are you working on another novel?
I'm primarily finishing that up now. I've done a draft of it, and we'll be going back at it shortly. And then I have a number of other projects sort of mapped out, including, I hope, a young adult book. But now that I've said this to a few people, I realize I may actually have to get down and write.
Actually do it?
Yeah.
How do you write? Do you write on a computer? Do you write longhand?
I wrote one of my novels straight to computer, and I think it was a mistake. I think I need to write something longhand. There are many aspects of that seems to be important. One is just and maybe it's just because I was raised on paper, but just seeing the paper, seeing the handwritten pages is somehow very encouraging and reassuring to me. And seeing them accumulate, even if they are pure garbage, just seeing the pile of them on my shelf sort of getting bigger day after day gives me tremendous confidence that I may actually be able to finish a project. And I think it also relieves the sort of editorial side of me. I can write more in one spurt without going back and changing words and starting from the beginning every day and spending, you know, a year doing the first 20 pages because I'm trying to make them perfect, as opposed to just writing the whole story out in one fell swoop and, you know, in 6 months, and then having that to work with to perfect.
And in the process of writing, do you find that you read a lot?
I do, off and on. I would like to read more. One of the problems I run into is I usually end up having to do a fair amount of research, or have had to for the last couple of books that I've done, and I don't get to read as much fiction as I'd like to. I'm one of those people who actually likes to read fiction. I find it really helps me when I'm writing, that it keeps reminding me what it's possible to do, that if I don't read fiction while I'm writing, I fall into bad habits, I fall into, you know, certain ways of expressing things, or I lose a sense of going beyond what seem to be my limits. Then I'll pick up a novel by, you know, a really gifted writer and see how they've solved some problem or where they've gotten to with their writing and think, oh, I can do that. I'd forgotten that, or I didn't know that. And it will help me solve some problem in my own writing.
Nino, it's been delightful having you on the program today. Continued good luck with the book.
Great. Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. The book is called The Origin of Species, $34.95 from Doubleday. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Lanto.